Mayors from across Florida plan for rising seas and a warming planet. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. And just ahead this morning, we'll tell you how Florida's mayors are leading in planning for climate change. What are they doing in Washington this week? Find out and join us. The number to call the show, 549-2937. Then later, the Jaguars make a big comeback in Cincinnati. Cole Pepper stops by the locker room for a little reaction from the team and the coach. But first this morning, Florida's mayors are in Washington this week. The American Flood Coalition is hosting its first ever Florida Mayors Summit in the nation's capital. 19 current mayors who represent more than 2 million Florida residents are going to hear from experts and talk to members of Congress about the issues of flooding and sea level rise. Now, with more than 1,300 miles of coastline, our state of Florida is more susceptible to sea level rise than any other state in the nation. And in the absence of real state leadership and federal leadership, many counties and cities around the Sunshine State are being forced to find ways to adapt to climate change on their own. We spoke with two mayors from our area about the Mayor's Summit. Let's begin with Mayor Elaine Brown of Neptune Beach.
When you talk about the fact that across Florida, sea levels will be rising about 7 inches over the next 20 years, even the smallest increase can cause increases in flooding. So we are preparing in many ways. One, we want to get an assessment done of our city, and then with that assessment, we'd be looking at how we could then prepare for surges and sea level rise in vulnerable parts of Neptune Beach.
Mayor Tracy Upchurch says St. Augustine is also laser focused on flooding and how to deal with it.
Remember, when we talk about flooding, we're talking about two different types of flooding. One is directly related to a tropical depression or hurricane. The other, and frankly, this is a greater part of our focus, is what we would call nuisance flooding, sunny day flooding, king tide, those seasonal multiple times a year when we have exceedingly high tides, particularly if they're associated with a rain event.
So we're going to begin the hour this Monday on the show with a closer look at the Florida Mayor's Summit in D.C. as we welcome WJCT's Brendan Rivers, who covers the environment and climate here at the station. Hey, Brendan.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Dr. Alec Bogdanoff. He's Florida Resilience Manager with the American Flood Coalition. Dr. Bogdanoff, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to news that nearly two dozen Florida mayors of their own accord have headed up to D.C. this week to figure out how to deal with the future impacts of climate change? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Alec Bogdanoff, this is the first ever Florida Mayor's Summit you've held with the American Flood Coalition. Not surprising, I guess, given Florida's vulnerability to flooding.
Absolutely. And first, I'd love to start with telling you a little bit about our coalition. So the American Flood Coalition is a nonpartisan group of political, military, business, and local leaders that have really come to drive adaptation to the reality of higher seas, stronger storms, and more frequent flooding. We know that Florida is on the front line of these problems, which was why we ultimately wanted to have the opportunity to bring mayors from a vulnerable state to our nation's capital to not only have them share best practices, but also help educate members of Congress about the issue.
Okay, two congressmen from our area, Democrat Al Lawson and Republican John Rutherford, are members of your Flood Coalition. What will their role be in all of this?
Certainly. So we have invited the congressmen to meet with mayors this evening at a meet and greet so they can have casual conversations. And then the mayors from the regions, both Mayor Upchurch and Mayor Brown, will be meeting with the members of Congress individually tomorrow.
What else will the mayors learn during this two-day event up there? About what learnings can they take back to their cities and counties to plan for, in particular, flooding?
Absolutely. And so one of the things we're seeing across the state is that the cities are laboratories of finding innovative solutions and ultimately Some cities have tried some solutions, other cities have tried different solutions. And so we want the mayors to talk about what has worked, what hasn't worked, and share best practices. And ultimately, as a fairly young organization, we're also trying to learn how to best support these mayors. They, you know, are asking for help from kind of the state, the federal government, and also organizations like us. And we're happy to help lead that effort.
And your title is Florida Resiliency Manager. So how important will resiliency be here in Florida in the coming decades if we are looking at 6, 7 or more inches of water rise at the coasts, and then also the impacts of inland flooding? Here in Jacksonville, we certainly experienced that after Hurricane Irma took so many people by surprise. How severe the inland flooding was after that storm?
Yeah, there is no doubt that Florida has challenges coming up, but I think, you know, I and the organization are very pleased with the leadership of Governor Ron DeSantis appointing Dr. Julia Neshwa as the state's first chief resilience officer. Her job is to think about flooding and sea level rise and bring people to the table. And ultimately, I think leadership on a state level, both through Dr. Neshwa and Secretary Valenstein, who's the Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, have really set the stage for Florida being a national and world leader to this issue.
So you see Florida getting much more proactive about this than in the past?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we as a state cannot wait until roads are flooding constantly and, you know, stormwater systems don't work and flood control systems don't work. We are seeing proactive leadership across the state now on a state and local level, and even regional level through the compacts that are being developed across the state.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Florida Mayor's Summit in D.C. this week. Nearly 24 Florida mayors are meeting with the American Flood Coalition to get better data and strategies to combat increased flooding, the future we're looking at of sea level rise, and other impacts of climate change. What are your questions? What are your concerns about climate change in your neighborhood? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Brendan Rivers, you cover climate change for WJCT and also at our digital magazine, adaptflorida.org, which looks at how Florida is adapting to climate change. And you've been looking at some polling info on climate change and sea level rise. What is that showing?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. So this is polling from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication and the George Mason Center for Climate Change Communication. And their data shows that 68% of Floridians accept that climate change is happening, but only 52% understand that it's due to human activity. And only half of those people polled said most scientists think global warming is happening. So there's just this wide misunderstanding. And I think that's due to a few things, two of which are actually answered in the polling data. So one is that only a third of people polled say they hear about climate change in the media at least once a week. And I think you and I are both trying to change that.
Yes, we are.
And about the same number of people say they talk about climate change at least occasionally. And then the other factor is that there's kind of been this culture war going on, and climate change has gotten caught up on that.
Right. Climate change is a politically divisive issue, even though it shouldn't be. These are mayors from both parties going up to D.C. to deal with this problem because it's an on the ground municipal problem. You've got to deal with sunny day flooding. You've got to deal with figuring out how to shore up the coastline. It shouldn't be partisan, but it is.
Right. And I think looking at this side of the picture, this resilience and dealing with the impacts of climate change rather than dealing with the causes is actually a good way to kind of cross that that partisan boundary, because at this point, especially in Florida, you can't ignore that this is happening. The evidence is there all the time. You can't say sea levels are not rising given all this stuff we're seeing. So you can get everybody to buy in and participate in these efforts to defend Florida from rising seas. So the other side is trying to get people to buy into the mitigation side of things and reduce emissions. And that seems to be more of a challenge. But this is a great start, I think.
Okay. It's 549-2937 to join us. Let's talk about that a little bit more. If you tend to be more politically conservative, you might say, well, adaptation and innovation will solve this problem. If you are more on the progressive side, you might be more inclined to say, no, we need adaptation and innovation, but we also need to drastically reduce carbon emissions right away. And that is the rub, isn't it? The disagreement on how to approach mitigating or lessening the worst impacts of climate change.
Right. But I think it's not, if you're talking about the solutions to what's causing climate change, that's not really that divisive if you stick to a certain kind of language. It's when you start saying climate change and when you're talking about this, it becomes an issue, because this same polling data that I was talking about earlier shows that Floridians overwhelmingly support policies that would reduce climate change. So, for instance, more than 80% say we should fund research into renewable energy sources. Mm-hmm. More than 70% say we should regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. 80% say there should be tax rebates for energy-efficient vehicles or solar panels. Nearly 80% say schools should teach climate change. So people tend to support policies that would help mitigate climate change, even if they don't believe climate change is man-made. And I think that's because people, even if they don't understand climate change itself, they understand that there are tons of economic, environmental, and health benefits to adopting policies that reduce pollutants.
Right. And it's 549-2937 as we talk with the American Flood Coalition this morning and our own reporter Brendan Rivers. Nearly 24 Florida mayors are in the nation's capital this week figuring out how to deal with climate change. It's the first ever Florida Mayors Summit. Mayors from across the state are there. Notably, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is not, but I don't believe the mayor of Orlando or Tampa is either. Is that right?
No, they were not on the list. And so I wouldn't be able to answer the question as to why they aren't there. I mean, I would assume those mayors have a lot on their plate.
Yeah.
Mayors like Upchurch and Elaine Brown, I think this issue is more front of mind for them because they're right there. They're on the front lines and they have a lot more to lose and a lot less funding to work with to address these issues.
Sure. Mayors of smaller coastal communities make up the bulk of the Florida Mayor Summit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's begin with Emily in Middleburg right now. Hi, Emily. Emily. Emily, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I'm absolutely thrilled that this coalition is going to D.C. I've been following what Miami is needed to do, raising streets and raising sidewalks. I live in Middleburg on Doctors Lake, and that water is, you know, it's steadily rising up near our houses. But I work in Jacksonville and Riverside at the hospital, and we were, you know, devastated by Irma.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a lot of innovation, and we need it now, and nobody can deny the water levels are rising. So thank you, guys. Go for it.
Thanks, Emily. You know, Alec Bogdanoff on the line with us from the American Flood Coalition in D.C. That caller, Emily, just pointed out three examples of how Florida is already dealing with climate change. Doctors Lake in Clay County, the South Florida response to rising waters, and then how businesses along the St. Johns River here in Jacksonville, like St. Vincent's Hospital, were absolutely hammered by the flooding in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. Now, she mentioned Miami and how they're raising streets and sidewalks. Well, what is what Miami-Dade is doing, is that going to be a model for other parts of the state, do you think?
I think that, you know, Mayor Francis Suarez of Miami is joining us up here, and I think some of the other mayors from around the state are very anxious to hear what he has to say as really a national and world leader in this topic. But what we're seeing in Miami, Miami Beach, across South Florida, Broward County even as well, the mayor of Broward County is joining us. We know that they have been having this conversation for longer than other folks just because of the regional issues. Some of the solutions they are implementing will work other places, some may not. And ultimately, this goes back to the cities being laboratories, that ultimately, you know, we're going to have the reality of trying things that may not work at first. But ultimately, if we can build a coalition of folks that can come together, we can find out why things didn't work, where they work best, and really help find solutions for individual cities that are best for them.
Yeah. Brendan Rivers, what works in Miami may not work in Jacksonville.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think It is true that there needs to sort of be these different regional strategies. But I think if you talk to these people, they're going to say they wish there was more state and federal buy-in. I think they would argue they've kind of been forced into this situation where they have to figure things out on their own.
What about that, Alec? I mean, Florida has recently gotten religion, so to speak, about climate change. But a lot of these mayors do feel pretty lonely in dealing with this.
And that is exactly why we hosted a Florida Mayor Summit. You know, the reality is water doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor. If you're in a place that is vulnerable to flooding and you have and there's a chance that you'll flood, there are solutions that we can implement today to help make sure that areas don't see a severe flooding. And that's really the path we want to take is, what are those proactive measures we can do on a state, local level, federal level even, to help make sure that the future is more vibrant and viable? And ultimately, the mayors are the best advocates because they're the ones who get the phone calls, right? If your street's flooding and that storm drain's backing up, they're not calling their member of Congress, they're calling their mayor. And so we know that these mayors have the stories that they can tell, bring them to the state and federal level, and really share what the challenges are and where they need support.
549-2937, getting lots of calls about flooding, climate change, and sea level rise in Florida as nearly two dozen Florida mayors head up to D.C. to learn how to combat these problems. What are your questions about this? Eric is on the south side right now. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning. I seldom hear the P word in any of your discussions about these topics, population growth. A child born today in Florida is going to see 60 to 70 million people by 2100. That's only 80 years away. Jacksonville's adding about 800 to 1,000 people a month. We have unlimited housing growth, high rises, single family homes along the intercoastal. I just see all these discussions as rather moot, Melissa. So that's my point.
Today. And why is that? Because you feel that. Oh, he hung up. Okay, Alec, let me get you to address that. The state is growing by leaps and bounds, although some who study this issue have projected that eventually Florida will lose population because of the impacts of climate change, that people will become essentially climate refugees. They'll move from South Florida to North Florida. Some people have already started to do that. And then eventually they may leave the state altogether, head inland to higher ground. What about population trends and Florida and climate change?
And I take this as an opportunity to talk about proactive planning. Ultimately, we have communities that, as we think about population growth, we need to think about where land is vulnerable, where land is less vulnerable, encourage development in places that is less vulnerable, and also start thinking about what we need to do when the time comes to, you know, handle those tough situations. And the reality is, you know, that's why we elect mayors. They are the decision makers. They are the ones that have to, you know, be able to communicate why they're doing what they're doing. Florida is a beautiful place to live. There, you know, there's really no place on earth quite like it, as I think all of us know. And to say that we're going to stop population growth isn't necessarily the right approach, I guess. The question is, how do we make sure that we can sustain our communities, build a resilient community for the population growth that we're going to expect?
That's going to become an increasingly urgent issue to deal with, Brendan. You've already been reporting on how some communities, including here in Jacksonville, are confronting this very sensitive topic of managed retreat. Right. On our own South Bank in downtown Jacksonville, the neighborhood of South Shores is already beginning a managed retreat because the homes are just too low-lying and they're going to continually get flooded out.
Right, and that's going to become more and more common. And I think this is one of the areas where communities are really going to need state and federal buy-in to help coordinate these things, because this is already happening in Miami. It's climate gentrification. So this is where traditionally wealthy people in that community lived, in coastal areas, right on the water. But as sea levels rising and flooding becomes worse and worse, they're starting to leave those areas and move inland to areas that were traditionally lower income. And that's raising the cost of living in those areas and forcing those lower income people out. And this is going to be more and more common throughout the state. People around on the coast, which is where most of Florida's population is concentrated, are going to start moving inland. And then that's going to have impacts on other communities. So there needs to be sort of this broader coordination, this broader help to help deal with these issues.
There will be ripple effects, the likes of which we probably can't even anticipate fully yet.
Yeah, and it's going to happen all over the country. I mean, here we think about sea level rise. Like that's the big issue here for climate change. But when you go inland, when you go to like the Midwest or something, their main issue is lack of water. And just they don't have enough water right now. And there's states that are fighting over fresh water resources. And there are these impacts all over the country, some that we don't see here in Florida. So there needs to be this broader effort to deal with this.
Ed is in the intercoastal area. Ed, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I guess my question is, I mean, I'm all for, you know, reducing humans' effects on climate. I'm not a huge believer in that humans are actually affecting the climate, because if you go back in history, the Ice Age, you know, and all that, you know, the Earth warmed and the ice went away or the ice came. I mean, yeah, climate does change. But more importantly, let's say that the humans are affecting climate. I mean, any local municipality, even Jacksonville, going all electric and taking cars off the road, in my opinion, is not really going to help anything, because you have 90% of the world spewing out carbon emissions. So, I mean, at a local level, how is that going to affect sea level change in Florida? That's my question.
All right, Ed, thanks for that. You know, these mayors aren't really looking at that in this conference. They're more dealing with infrastructure issues.
Right.
How to keep the water out of people's homes. But I want to talk about his point for a minute. First to say, and I appreciate your call, Ed, first to say that it is the overwhelming consensus of the scientific community that human activity is contributing to climate change via carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. The second point he made, that, you know, why should a local city push electric cars and measures like that? It won't make even a dent. This gets back to what you were saying, Brendan, which is that it's the belief of climate scientists, certainly, and people who work on this issue all the time, that we need a global coordinated response.
Right. I want to kind of get back to the first thing he said, too. Yeah, it is true that the climate does change cyclically. That has happened throughout the history of the Earth. But the problem is right now it's happening much faster than it's ever happened. And carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are much higher than they've ever been throughout human existence. And the overwhelming scientific consensus, as you said, Melissa, is that that's because of man-made greenhouse gas emissions. So there is no scientific doubt that what is happening right now is being caused by humans. And yes, the Earth has been warmer in the past, but we weren't alive when that happened. So it is a big issue. There needs to be a wide scale reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. But you can't just wait for there to be this one giant effort to do it. It needs to start somewhere. Everybody needs to contribute. There's not a global government that's going to say, yes, everybody, we have to stop emitting now.
Some states, some cities are leading on those types of initiatives.
Yeah. And you got to start small and work your way up. It's kind of a weird argument to me. To hear, because I hear a lot of people say that other people aren't doing it, so what's the point in us doing it? But we know what the solution is. Why not do what we can? And I mean, America's traditionally taken on a leadership role in the world. Why not take a leadership role on this and show others that it can be done and help others get there?
549-2937. Mark is on the west side. Hi, Mark. Hello.
I think somebody stole my thunder earlier, but it makes it's a point that bears repeating. Until Florida gets serious about saying no to growth, which will never happen, of course, this is kind of moot. I mean, you know, Jacksonville can't get out of its own way giving money away to lure people down here and businesses down here. And, we're saying one thing with the left hand and we're saying another thing with the right hand. I mean, it does no good to plan for global warming and climate change and sea level rise and all this stuff when, hey, you 100,000 people up north, come on down. Florida's welcoming and we're ready for you. And I mean, you know, I've been here. I'm a second, third generation Floridian. I would love to see Florida say, you know, from January 1st, 2025, we're not accepting any more people. But you know they're not going to do that. It's so.
Yeah.
It's pointless.
Well, Mark, thanks for that. Okay, that's the second call we've gotten about population growth here in Florida, which is a fast-growing state. And you know, it's impossible to completely predict the future, Brendan, but at a certain point in the future, when will this huge and fast-growing population meet the reality of these unsustainable climate impacts? That is, you know, frankly, a nightmare scenario that the state will eventually have to deal with. Or another scenario might be that people just start moving out of Florida, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah, and I think that's something we're definitely going to see at some point if we continue on this current track. Because, population growth is a huge issue. I mean, the New York Times just released this analysis on transportation emissions and looking at Jacksonville specifically, per person emissions from driving have gone down by about 5%. But due to population growth, the city's emissions from transportation has grown by a lot. I think it was 40%.
Here's a tweet from Jim. Yes, effective growth management goes a long way in relation to resiliency and climate preparation. When it comes to managing growth, it's time for Florida to get back in the game. He links to an article showing that Florida abandoned its role in managing growth during Rick Scott's tenure as governor. Now Governor Ron DeSantis has a chance to get aggressive about that growth management. Will that the DeSantis administration look at that?
I don't know. I mean, the problem is Florida's economy is based on that growth.
Exactly.
Florida depends on people moving here. That's where most of the state's money comes from.
Apparently, in 2011, Governor Scott and the legislature enacted a law that abolished the Department of Community Affairs. That was the state's growth management agency. And so that has been something that apparently continues to have an impact today. It has, and this has to do with planning decisions. When you see a community rise up against a new development that they think will overpopulate their neighborhood, or even rise up against a Walmart or whatever it is, you see that over and over again in Florida. Mm-hmm. Citizens resisting growth that they feel is untrammeled.
Right, but then the elected leaders tend to see that they need the money that could come from these projects, I think. So I guess to really address this, we'd have to rethink how we deal with that in Florida. I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know when it'll come or if it'll come, but it is a very important part of this discussion.
The group 1,000 Friends of Florida in 2016 issued a report called Trouble in Paradise, urging state leaders to reestablish a planning agency and enforce growth management laws. You know, this, given that we've gotten two calls about this already, maybe we need to get into this on our digital website magazine on climateadaptflorida.org. Let's go to Dave at the beaches. Hi, Dave.
Morning, Melissa. The planning tool that's available and has been available for over 28 years is called Life Cycle Carbon Emissions. And your major automotive manufacturers and building material manufacturers recognized over 20 years ago that they needed to start to reduce the pollution created by their products. These tools are available and ready for use. The barrier are not the science. The barrier is not the engineering. The barrier is not the planning. The barrier is the politicians who listen to propagandists who refuse to recognize the external cost of unsustainable development. We can do this. We have the solutions.
Dave,
in my lifetime, greenhouse gas pollution has increased 40% since the end of World War II. That's human cause. This is not unknown. This is your facts. We need to work on facts, not ideology and belief.
Dave, thanks for that. And we have an email about this too from Mike on the South Side. He says, global swarming, population growth is far more pressing than warming. Projected future population growth is a key component. So our very unscientific poll of calls from listeners shows some anxiety about our rapidly growing state, Brendan. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I understand those concerns, and especially in Florida when we rely on the environment, we rely on our water resources, and this rapid growth threatens those things.
We'll continue to follow it on this program and also at our website, adaptflorida.org, and have an update as the mayors come back from D.C. We were joined by Dr. Alec Bogdanoff, Florida Resilience Manager at the American Flood Coalition, and our own reporter, Brendan Rivers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, later in the hour, the Jaguars make a comeback in Cincinnati. Cole Pepper has reaction from Coach Doug Marrone. But up next, building your emotional intelligence at work. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In sub-Saharan Africa, hundreds of millions of people live without electricity. Women often cook over indoor fires, and children study by the light of kerosene lamps. But burning wood and fuel pollutes homes and warms the climate. So one organization helps women in Nigeria and Tanzania bring clean and renewable energy to their communities.
They themselves are kind of the best ambassadors for clean energy.
Fid Thompson is with Solar Sister. The nonprofit helps women start businesses selling clean cook stoves, solar lamps, and other solar products. Solar Sister mentors the women and provides them with inventory. Thompson says the saleswomen use the products themselves and can personally describe the benefits.
They are really passionate about what clean energy can do for their communities.
For example, a clean cook stove.
It frees up time for women who are usually disproportionately burdened with the gathering wood or going to find charcoal.
It also saves the money spent buying fuel and improves family health by reducing indoor air pollution. So these women are helping protect the climate and their communities and making money in the process. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at WJCT.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
Welcome back. Well, if you're looking to become a stronger leader, both at work and maybe at home, it turns out success is an inside job. That is, in terms of your emotional intelligence. In other words, look within before you seek to lead in the external world. Kelly Manel is founder and president of Image Partners, Inc., and a thought leader in the field of emotional intelligence. She's leading a two-day workshop this weekend so you can learn how mindfulness and emotional intelligence, or EI, drive success. Kelly Manel, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So how do we define emotional intelligence?
Oh, my goodness. What a good question.
Mm-hmm. See, you have such good emotional intelligence. Yeah. You complimented me on my question.
Well, the first thing I want to share with you is that the key thought leader on this, there's a lot of people that have done research, but Daniel Goleman would define it as, how do we manage ourselves? How do we understand ourselves? So it's self-awareness. And also, how do then we manage ourselves? So that would be self-management. And then also being aware of others in the environment, so that we would call that social awareness. And then the last component would be relationship management. So then from the inside out is the self, and then all the way to other. How do we manage ourselves? All the way to, how do we manage our relationships in our world? Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. And understandably, this is something that everybody could be doing a better job of, particularly in the workplace.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is turn on the news and or read the SHRM magazine or ATD magazine, and you see lots of good examples of why we need to figure out how to work with our relationships at work. Some of the best-selling classes are how to deal with conflict at work and how to deal with that boss or the bullying. And so there are so many subjects people struggle with at work. And so that's why I recommend people, if they get a coach or a trainer in their organization or an organizational development person, find somebody who is skilled and certified in emotional intelligence, because all leadership application rests on those competencies. And yes, they are competencies. And the good news, the best news, is that we can develop these for the rest of our lives. So from the first day that you're introduced to them to the day that you leave, then you can develop them. So that's the best news.
So when people come to this workshop, what are some practical examples of what they'll take back to their team at work or even their own family that they can put into practice?
Right. So to your point, you know, the same person goes to work, goes home. So when we develop these skills, we exhibit them everywhere we go, right? So what we're going to shoot for people that are coming are renewed purpose, increased resilience, developing our deeper empathy and compassion, improving our relationships, reduce our stress response, and improve our mindfulness, which is a way that we can develop our self-awareness and so forth. So what are some of the areas that it exhibits? Well, it exhibits growth mindset, help us with stress management both inside and how we externalize that. We can engage and inspire leaders. We can build our agility, flexibility, and adaptation. We can have what we call radical collaboration with others. That includes our family as well, right?
Why is collaboration radical?
Well, to the point where I'm listening to your program just prior to this, and I'm listening to the gentleman talked about Adapt Florida and the notion that we need to work together. So this notion of radical collaboration can mean, for instance, what he's talking about is working with people all over the state, all over the country, on new sets of initiatives that will help Florida understand the situation that we're in with climate and with the change in the environment. And that is what we call an adaptation, flexibility. Those are EI skills. So it exhibits itself on a leadership platform.
Now, you also will help participants improve mindfulness. Define mindfulness.
So the notion around mindfulness is, on a base level, mindfulness is just being present. It's being where you are when you're there, right? So the gentleman, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's worked in the mindfulness community for over 40-some years, defines it as just being where you are, being present. And so the notion of not being in the past, not living there in the moment, not living in the future, but just being right here where you are right now.
So that you can really understand the person across the table from you and honor the time you're spending with them. It gets harder and harder to do that because you go into a meeting at work and everyone has their phones right there. And when you're pressed for time, you're scrolling through your phone, answering emails while you're in a meeting, dealing with something else. That's not really good mindfulness, is it?
No, it's not. And so I do encourage all the folks that I teach and in the classes and in my coaching to find ways to detox out of technology and to use it in a smart way, right? And I use a little acronym I call about awareness, being aware, and then smart. So how can I be aware with what's going on and then how I can be smart with that information? So I can be aware that everybody's addicted to technology, including myself potentially, and then how can I be smart with that information? How can I be present? So to your point, if there's somebody we want to be present with, whether it's somebody at work or our children at the dining room table, these techniques work for all those scenarios.
Now, this workshop is open to everyone, and it's called Success is an Inside Job. In a moment, we'll tell you how you can get your tickets. But in particular, I would think this is a really valuable two-day experience for managers. Is that
right? Absolutely, yeah. And anybody that's leading, and really anybody that's leading themselves, leading a family, leading an organization. I do have a number of people that are leading organizations coming, and so they'll be looking to practice some technique and some conversations. So we're going to be talking about how to handle difficult conversations, for instance, in a mindful way. And we're going to give them specific techniques to that. That seems to be a very popular aspect of these kinds of things.
That's probably one of the hardest things a CEO or a senior leader has to do.
Absolutely. And typically people will bring up in these sessions, how do I give a performance review in a positive way? How do I help develop people in a positive way, especially when there's so much going on? And so we help people frame that up and give them tools to figure out how they're going to do that better.
I would think, too, the people coming to your workshop already have a lot of self-awareness or they wouldn't be coming. You know, I've worked for plenty of people who thought they were doing everything just great and they didn't have any emotional intelligence.
I understand.
So they're already halfway there because they're coming to see you.
Well, they're aware that they might need these skills, right? And they're trying to grow teams. A lot of them that have signed up have called me and said, hey, I'm growing my organization and we're expanding exponentially. And how do I bring all these people on and help get all the vision together? And this is just beyond what anybody understood in the beginning. And so people find themselves, all organizations find themselves in situations where we just need these extra leadership skills when we need them.
I think there's a stereotype that women are better than men at EI, but is that really true?
Well, on a technical level, the science does show that women have slightly more, they will score a little bit better on a number of those aspects that might include empathy and compassion. And there are a number of specific competencies that if you were to take an assessment, which I deliver in a lot of these sessions, people do see women having slightly better. But I would like to just say that overall, it just is across the board with, you know, depending on your background and experience, some people come into this world with a little bit more of these skills. And a lot of people who exhibit more have been trained at home, for instance, or had a nurturing school system where they've learned how to build conversations around their emotions and how to use those emotions constructively at work and at home. It's interesting you bring that up, Melissa, that when this is applied in like K-12, for instance, you see scores going up. Test scores going up, and you see bullying going down and absenteeism go down. So this isn't just for grownups. This is for people. I tell people this is for anybody that's breathing.
And yeah, I agree with you. They should teach this in schools more broadly. That is a great notion.
Yeah.
But for adults, Success is an Inside Job is the big workshop coming up this Friday and Saturday by Kelly Manel, founder of Image Partners, Inc., a thought leader nationally in emotional intelligence. You'll learn how mindfulness and emotional intelligence drive your success. This is happening Friday and Saturday at Epping Forest Yacht Club. Get your tickets now. There's only a few left at Eventbrite. Just search Success is an Inside Job.
Thank you, Melissa.
Always great to see you.
Thank you, Melissa. You too.
And in a moment, did you watch the game? What a game, right? And you know what? My husband, a Bengals fan, you won't believe what he had to say about all this. As the Jaguars come back in Cincinnati, that's right. Culpepper has some sound from the locker room and talked to some of the team. He's going to take us through the game and share some more sports news and notes from the weekend right after this. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
Performers live from the WJCT soundstage. WJCT and the Florida Theater offers a unique and intimate venue to enjoy performances in close proximity to artists. For more info, visit floridatheater.com.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2 possesses an overwhelming depth of melody. You'll hear it performed by the symphony and piano virtuoso Natasha Peremski, whom the London Classical Source calls fiery and widely dynamic. Piano virtuoso Natasha Peremsky joins the symphony for Brahms' wonderfully melodic Piano Concerto No. 2, October 25th and 26th.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Shaw Chiropractic. Since 2007, Drs. Chad and Andrea Shaw have been helping their practice members find the connection between their spinal structure and their body's function and helping them to heal without drugs or surgery. Learn more at shawchirojacks.com.
During the War of 1812, the British built a fort in Spanish colonial Florida that became a free black settlement. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will visit Prospect Bluff. We'll discuss the 1947 Marjorie Stoneman Douglas book, The Everglades, River of Grass, and the Dade Massacre of 1835. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Around 1 in 8 women in the U.S. has trouble getting pregnant. Fertility clinics can be expensive and the medicine complicated. What happens when a doctor abuses their position of power? A new investigation looks at what can go wrong in the struggle to bring life into the world. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars keep their season alive with a comeback win in Cincinnati. Did you watch the game? Our own Cole Pepper did. He has some thoughts, as he does every Monday for us. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, the defense deserves credit for this one. Even with a 100-yard rusher, Leonard Fournette, and a 100-yard receiver, DeeDee Westbrook, it was up to the Jaguars defense to get the job done yesterday in Cincy. The Jags forced 4 turnovers in the second half, including an interception return for a touchdown by defensive end Yannick Ngakoue, only the second Jaguars defensive lineman to do that in a regular season game. And the Jaguars kept the Bengals winless with a 27-17 win in Ohio. It certainly was not a work of art, but it was a win.
We're able to win the game and give us a lot of things to work on both sides of the ball and get ourselves ready to go back home and play the New York Jets. That's it. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm not going to get down.
Doug right. Marone looking trying positive. To look on the positive side. And listen, there are a lot of things that if the Jaguars had not made those plays in the second half, this would be a much different Monday. And you'd have a lot of folks wondering where this season was going. As it is, they sort of allowed the season to continue from an expectation of contending for the postseason. They should beat the Jets. They're a 4.5-point favorite. And then they go to London, where they always seem to play well, although last year notwithstanding, and take on Houston. If they can get to the bye week at 5-4, they'll be right in this thing and maybe looking for the playoffs. So I think the next 2 weeks are going to tell us an awful lot.
And, you know, I know we're here to talk about the Jaguars, but poor Cincinnati, man. In my own household, it was kind of sad. I live with someone who's followed the Bengals through all of their mostly bad news for a long time, and it's really sad for them.
Well, it could come to a boiling point about week 15 of the NFL season, week 16. By then, both the Bengals and Dolphins could be 0-14 when they face one another. And it will likely be a battle for the first pick in the draft. Whoever stinks more gets that first pick.
That's right.
So now the Jaguars prepare to host the Jets Sunday. Again, this is a game that could be a defining game in this month, which is a defining month in the season for the Jaguars. And, of course, the Jaguars won and forced 4 turnovers without Jalen Ramsey on the roster, finally traded and made his debut with the Rams. Before he did, he did a sit-down interview with ESPN and basically blamed everything on Tom Coughlin without ever saying Tom Coughlin's name.
But everyone knows. So how is that playing with the fan base here and out there with the Rams?
Yeah, too. I don't know how the folks in L.A. are thinking of it. I assume that at this point they're excited to have a player of Ramsey's talent and are willing to buy some of the lines that he's feeding about wanting to be a good teammate and doing what's best for the team. Jalen Ramsey wants to do what's best for Jalen Ramsey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I asked Mark Brunell about what was important about being a good teammate in the NFL. What do you look for? And he said, very simply, don't let the guy next to you down. Well, I think he let a lot of guys next to him down here in Jacksonville by, playing up the injury to the back, by staying away from offseason workouts. He says that the fact that Coughlin called him out, by the way, Coughlin didn't call him out by name, said all players should be here for the offseason workouts, which are voluntary, said he was made to seem like a bum. The problem is that's never what Jalen Ramsey was made out to be by this organization, by the media, by anybody else. He was made out to be a guy who was being selfish and wasn't understanding the impact he would have on the rest of his team. While most of the guys in the locker room tell me he was not a distraction while he was going through this whole saga, I think the Jaguars can breathe a bit of a breath of fresh air knowing they don't have to answer those questions or worry about whether Jalen Ramsey is going to play for them or not anymore.
So you don't see it as a huge loss for them,
It's a big loss on the field. There's no doubt about it. They are not a better team, not a better defense with Jalen Ramsey somewhere else. I do think they're a better locker room. And how a locker room handles adversity oftentimes is the difference between a successful season and an unsuccessful season.
All right, let's talk college football. Just 12 days away from the Florida-Georgia game. I can't believe that.
You're going Florida-Georgia? I'm going Georgia.
Oh, sorry, Georgia-Florida.
Just because, again, whoever won last year, I tend to give the props to this time around. The RVs will be arriving in about a week. Second straight year that both teams are likely to come in ranked in the top 10. Florida's number 7. Georgia is number 10. If they remain that way through their bye weeks, it'll be just the third time since 1985 that both teams are in the top 10 when they meet. Florida's coming off a win over South Carolina, while Georgia topped Kentucky. Both have one loss on the year, and this game, in addition to being a great rivalry game, now also becomes a de facto SEC East Championship game. There was a lot on the line in this one. Should be a fun week in Jacksonville, as always.
All right. Always good to have your sports news and notes. You can watch Cole every night on TV at our news partner, News for Jax. Catch him every Monday here and follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Thanks, as always.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bordsfield is station digital editor. We always want your feedback. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Coming up tomorrow, a spotlight on the work of Jacksonville's GRASP Academy. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep it right there for some great music, and we will see you in the morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.